Support for Uncommon Ground comes from Peerspace, a website helping teams escape the office for meetings, events, and more. Peerspace offers 1,000 spaces in the Bay Area for any activity, including galleries for trainings. Peerspace.com.
Everyone, welcome. Thank you so much for being here at the Spur Urban Center with us. This event is part of KQED On Common Ground, a new live events program in partnership with local cultural institutions invested with the public trust to bring people together for civil discourse about how to face a future of economic, cultural, and environmental uncertainty by asking what our shared responsibilities to the common good are. This event series is part of our larger initiative, KQED 2020, that will, over the course of the next year and a half, across all our platforms, ask our audiences to consider what it means to participate in a democracy. Tonight's discussion, co-presented with our partners here at Spur, the member-supported urban planning think tank, is the second in a series that explores the ways economic inequality is fraying at the social fabric of the Bay Area and what we can do about it. Across three events, we are examining this threat to the common good built on secure housing, work, and education. Each convenes a panel of ranging expertise and opinions about the fundamental local causes of these inequalities, the impact they have on our democratic institutions, and how best to respond as a community. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our host tonight, and for each in this series, KQED's evening anchor and Friday Forum host, Mina Kim.
Thank you, Ryan. And thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. It's so great to have all of you here. And thank you for that introduction as well to our series, which, as Ryan mentioned, today is focused on work. And we often hear that the Bay Area's economy, California's economy, they are outperforming the nation. But as we all know, a lot of people in this region are not feeling that boom. The high cost of living, the high cost of housing, low wage growth, those are all compounding economic inequality here. And it raises the question, what are the prospects for workers, especially low-income, middle-income workers, as what are viewed as threats like automation or even changes in the gig economy and the fact that more workers are entering the gig economy, changing the relationship between employers and employees. What are the prospects for workers? And how are we doing at the policymaking level to support workers through some of the big transitions that we are already experiencing and expect to experience? Let me introduce our wonderful panelists to you. Jed Kolko is sitting sort of two over from me. He is chief economist at Indeed, the world's largest online job site. Previously, he was chief economist and VP of analytics at the real estate site Trulia. He's also senior fellow at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, advisor to the Shift Commission on Work, Workers, and Technology, convened by the New America Foundation and Bloomberg, and advisor at Orbital Insight. He's also a board member at the California Budget and Policy Center. Welcome, Jed Kolko.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Next to him is Natalie Foster. She is the co-founder of the Economic Security Project, a fund to support the exploration and experimentation of a guaranteed income. She's also an advisor to the Aspen Institute Future of Work Initiative. Natalie co-founded and launched peers.org to support people who work in the sharing economy. And before that, she was the CEO and co-founder of Rebuild the Dream, a platform for people-driven economic change with Van Jones. So good to have you here, Natalie Foster. And next to me is Aegon Terpelin. He is Senior Advisor for Economic Development and Transportation for the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, correct?
And Planning and Research.
And Planning and Research. He's the former Regional Planning Director here at Spur, where his work focused on the intersection of economic development, regional planning, workforce preparation, transportation, and governance. He is on a number of boards and committees, including San Francisco's Workforce Investment Board. So thank you for being here, Aegon Terpelin.
It's wonderful to be back at Spur. Thank you.
Yeah. And so, Aegon, I mentioned some of the trends that we are seeing in the Bay Area, automation, the gig economy, the rise of the gig economy. What else would you add in terms of important trends that we should be aware of here that are affecting the Bay Area labor market?
Well, I think as a starting point, we think of the Bay Area is very much obviously a part of California, and we are in the midst of really an unprecedented economic boom statewide, 114 months of continued job growth. We've never had that in recorded record. The state has over $3 trillion economy, and the Bay Area is one of the drivers of that overall. But as you alluded to in the very beginning, it's not that these trends are not feeling positive for everybody. We really are, as a state and as a region, feeling increasingly fissures. 1 in 5 people in California are at or near the poverty line. Homelessness rates have been growing 40%, 50% per year. And going back a number of decades, one of the big trends that you see is most of the wage gains have gone to the very top. And a lot of folks, particularly the median wage jobs, have been flat going back several decades. So what we really have right now is a crisis in access to quality jobs. We really kind of honed down to what is the challenge we're facing. There's insufficient amount of quality jobs. A lot of the job growth is at the top end and at the bottom end, but not nearly as much in the middle.
And what would you add to that, Jed Kolko, in terms of how the labor market is sort of playing out here in San Francisco, here in the Bay Area? And then also, if you want to, you can connect it to the rest of the state, as Egon mentioned, some of the statewide issues that he's seeing as well.
Great, thanks. I think it's important to keep in mind that there are both long-term trends going on in the labor market, automation, technological change, the rise of some online platforms, questions about alternative work arrangements, the aging population, other demographic trends. These are long-term trends that have been going on and are likely to continue. At the same time, overlaid on that is where we are in this labor market cycle. Over the long term, as Egon mentioned, we're seeing rising inequality across lots of dimensions. But at the moment, with a particularly tight labor market, when unemployment's very low and there are actually a much higher than usual number of open jobs per unemployed worker, in a tight labor market, some of those gaps actually start to narrow. Recently, wage gains have been highest in low-wage industries. And this is a moment when firms are looking beyond their usual candidates, changing their job requirements, because they're having more difficulty hiring than in other times. So we're at a moment in the labor market cycle where people who might not otherwise have had opportunities can take advantage of it being such a tight labor market, but that won't last forever. And instead, we'll go back to some of these long-term trends without this added tailwind of a tight labor market.
When you say that the wage gains have been made in the lowest brackets, does that also mean the income inequality gap is sort of getting reduced, or at the higher end where the wage gains also extremely high there, so the gap is remaining the same?
So this does get into the weeds slightly. Right now in a tight labor market, wage gains are actually a bit higher in percentage terms in lower wage industries, but overall household inequality also has to do with how many people in the household are working, what other kinds of income aside from wage and salary income people are getting, and those other factors continue to contribute to widening inequality. So there are a few different things going on, but at least when we talk about the labor market, and most importantly, the effects of a tight labor market that we're in today, one of the effects of a tight labor market is that some of those gaps start to narrow, if only temporarily.
Natalie Foster.
I think it's important to name that we have had good news recently around, you know, a small increase in wages across the state and across the country, but that is on the heels of 50 years of wage stagnation, where you have an entire generation who've worked their whole lives and flatlined wages, during which the country was very, very economically prosperous. So the graph, you know, the numbers for prosperity go straight up, the numbers for wages stay flat. And that has a really outsized impact on people of color and families of color as well. So if you look at sort of just the impact that has on the net worth, 7%, black families have 7% the wealth that white families have. And if we do nothing, you know, about that gap, by the middle of the century, black and Latinx wealth will be at $0. And that's at a moment, you know, when we're in great prosperity. So yes, wages are one piece of the puzzle, but overall net worth is another piece of the puzzle. And I think we have to look at both to really measure the health of the region.
Aegon, you want to get in?
Yeah, this is a really important issue that if you look at wages, income inequality is a serious issue. Wealth inequality is much more severe and much more extreme. And so I think Natalie gave the average white family in the United States has 10 times the wealth of the average black family. And that is just a statistic that's staggering. And there's a lot of historic and more recent factors that go into this that we really have to attack head on. But then just specifically on the wage side, the economy is not working well for many people, for most people. One in three Californians earns less than $15 an hour. But over half of Latino workers, Latinx workers, earns less than $15 an hour. So there still is a significant gap. And that is, if you think about that from the standpoint of the Bay Area, we looked at some of these numbers a couple years ago in the context of the Bay Area. Over a third of the Bay Area workers were earning less than $18 an hour. It's a little bit higher here than the rest of the state, but the cost of living is much more extreme in this region. So there's many, many people that are earning wages that are virtually insufficient for them to survive in the environments that they're living in.
And so what are the prospects for low and middle income workers in the Bay Area? Work prospects, I guess, initially, besides the question of whether or not they can continue to live here. Jed Kolko, if you want to speak to that.
I think the biggest challenges come from housing and the cost of living. You know, when we think about where the Bay Area and California stand relative to the U.S. overall, on most labor market measures, the Bay Area and California look pretty strong, whether we're looking at job growth, unemployment, wages, and so on. Where California and the Bay Area especially really stand out, of course, is the cost of living. And once you adjust for the cost of living, which is primarily driven by housing costs, the wages that you need to live here are way out of sync with elsewhere. That pushes people out. It prevents people from moving here. It pushes jobs out. There are lots of kinds of occupations that end up being much less common in the Bay Area and California because it doesn't make sense for employers to pay the additional wages they would need to compensate for the high cost of living if they could put those jobs elsewhere.
And so can you give examples of what some of those jobs are?
So some of those jobs include the kinds of jobs that can be done remotely or using technology, call center jobs, customer service reps, other kinds of back office jobs that don't need to be face-to-face with customers. There's also a set of industries that use more land that make less sense to locate in a place like California and certainly the Bay Area where land is more expensive. So manufacturing tends to be a smaller share of the California economy is in manufacturing than in the U.S. overall. Then there are other kinds of jobs that tend not to exist here as much because our consumption is somewhat different. A very expensive place where people have less land, they're less likely to live in big houses, there's less demand for things like landscaping and car repair and other kinds of ways in which consumption patterns end up being different in expensive places.
I feel like you're really talking about a lot of steady middle-income jobs when you say that. And so is that contributing to what has been described as like the hollowing out of the middle class here in the region?
Yeah, I think there's a broader trend, and this is, when we're talking about hollowing out, I mean, this is very much a national trend.
Yes.
The fastest job growth is expected to be in high-wage jobs, those that require a bachelor's or a graduate degree, followed by the lowest-wage jobs. Many of those jobs are harder to automate, harder to offshore. A lot of them are person-to-person in-face service jobs, less threatened by automation, but still low-wage and precarious. The jobs most threatened by automation and other forces are more likely to be middle-wage jobs. Those include some jobs like manufacturing and other jobs like sales, office, clerical, and admin jobs.
Aegon Triplin.
This is an interesting moment to think about historically, though, because manufacturing jobs were not always well-paying jobs. They were not always middle-wage. And so there's actually a very important role of policy, unionization rates as factors that have led to some jobs that historically were not well paid becoming better paid. So a lot of the industries that Jeb was talking about that are low wage, we can, through action, turn those low wage jobs into middle wage jobs. And I think that's an important consideration as we have going forward. Also on the geographic piece, something important, what one industry Jed sort of referenced, but we need to remember is goods movement and logistics. Think about all the people that order things online right now. There's a massive footprint of that in warehouses and trucking, and those exist some in the Bay Area, but a lot just over the Altamont Pass in the northern San Joaquin Valley. It is functionally a part of the Bay Area economy. The people that are working in those warehouses, that are driving those trucks, are fully integrated economically, but aren't in the 9-county Bay Area region. And so when we think about what has happened to the economy and as things shifted out, there are people living and working just outside the boundaries that are very much integrated. So from the state perspective, we're really trying to think a lot about that and also tell a story of how we are interconnected and interdependent. And given that, suggest some kind of policy action.
I want to get into that a little bit more, but before we do, what I'm hearing you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that the Bay Area will continue to create a lot of high-wage jobs and a lot of low-wage jobs. And I think the big question raised by Aegon here about what will be the quality of life for people with low-wage jobs, that's a big question. And there are policies that we could put in place to ensure that those are quality jobs or that they at least lead to a quality of life that is sustainable. So, Natalie Foster, I mean, can you address that? What are some ways that we can ensure that?
Yeah, I think there's one other factor here. You know, not all low-wage jobs look alike. There has been a long trend here as well that is the fissuring of the workplace. So it used to be that a low-wage janitor had the same health insurance plan that the CEO had at any given company, right? Everyone worked for the company. And over the last several decades, the fissuring of work has happened to where we contract out the low-wage work. We make it temporary. We make it seasonal. We move to contracting firms. And the gig economy is a piece of this. It's a very small piece of this. It's a piece we talk about a lot. Only 2% really of Californians actually participate in the gig economy. But 1 in 10 people earn their incomes in a non-traditional way. And the challenge with that kind of work is that it's even more precarious than traditional low-wage work. It's work that is done outside of employment often, so outside of benefits, often outside of protections, means that, you know, people certainly have no union and have very little income supplement like health insurance or things that you know sit alongside wages that help to stabilize the middle class. So I think we'll have to address that alongside wages to really make a big difference. But another piece of all this is the fact that we have neglected the social safety net for the last 50 years. We've let it fray in a very disgraceful way, I would argue. And so when people do fall through the cracks, when there is a change in the labor market, we are living through the retail apocalypse right now. Every week is another retail chain that is going out of business, putting hundreds and thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of low-wage workers out of jobs overnight. And you know what happens when there are disruptions in the labor market? And I think that is one of the reasons there's a lot more attention now being paid to the social safety net and the stability that it can provide in people's lives. Everything from more robust paid family leave to guaranteeing an income as part of the overall income portfolios that people have.
And so the fraying of the social safety net, so the need to really strengthen that, which, of course, efforts also need to be made on the local and state level around all of that. There are also a couple of other strategies that I know you've really looked closely at, one being portable benefits mm-hmm. and the other being guaranteed income. We could talk about either one of those. Which one would you like to start with?
Well, the big idea behind portable benefits is that you know, look, 100 years ago, essentially, the big auto workers' unions sat down with the auto manufacturers and hammered out a deal that became the Treaty of Detroit. And it basically put in motion our safety net today. It said that employers are responsible for the benefits and protections of the workers in exchange for the loyalty that the workers would give, 40, 50 years at a company, and then you would retire, and the firm would take care of you. There was a pension. There was health insurance for you and your family, maybe even a gold watch. Those days are gone in most parts of the country and never existed for many, many families as well. And what we have in place now is basically nobody is responsible, and the government hasn't stepped in over the last several decades to really fill that void. And so what I think we in California could do is figure out what does the future of the social safety net look like? And it may need to live with the worker as the worker moves from job to job. Employers are responsible and should absolutely pay in, but it may be that the worker should have their benefits and protections that allow for stability as they move through their work lives.
One of the biggest challenges in the economy, and this is nationally over decades, is actually not that change is happening so fast, but in fact, the economy's gotten less dynamic than it used to be. People change jobs, if anything, less often. Firms are less likely to be born. People are more and more working for larger and larger firms. You know, even though we think about startups here in the Bay Area, in fact, fewer people over time are working for small firms. And most importantly, fewer people move geographically than they used to. People used to move roughly once every 5 years. Now it's closer to once every 9 years. All of these barriers to mobility, this decline in dynamism, is a problem as the economy does change, as people in occupations that might grow slowly due to automation need to look either to other places or other careers. Whatever we can do to make those transitions easier is essential. And benefits that are tied to your current employer are a barrier to mobility. If you stay with your employer because you don't want to lose your insurance, that's a barrier to moving. There are lots of other barriers too, such as non-competes, which generally are not enforceable in California. Occupational licensing that doesn't let you take your license and practice your craft in another state, those are also barriers. So the fewer things that are tied to employment that you'll lose or will have to or become more precarious if you switch jobs or switch locations, the fewer things like that there are, the better that is for the economy.
You're listening to On Common Ground, Economic Inequality and the Future of Work, a presentation of Spur and KQED. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to On Common Ground. We're talking about the future of work and income inequality with Aegon Turplin of Governor Newsom's office, Jed Kolko of Indeed, and Natalie Foster of the Aspen Institute. She's responding to a question about who should be responsible for making workers' benefits more portable.
I would argue it's a combination of employers, companies, and the government. And there's one other actor I think that should be important here, and that's the role of unions and sort of the future of the labor movement. There is a world where labor organizations administer the benefits and protections to workers as a way of ensuring that there's some balance of power in a labor market. And I think California is in a really good position to be leading on innovation in that way.
And just one last thing, though, please. About who's responsible.
Yes.
I think one challenge, you know, as we think about making it possible for people to be mobile across places, across careers, is what level of government, at what level of government should we think about some of these initiatives like portable benefits? And one of the challenges, if we think about this at a local or state level rather than the national level, is that sometimes state-level benefits end up themselves potentially being a barrier to mobility. If you're going to not have the same health insurance options if you leave the state, That may be a barrier to moving. If people vote in such a way to protect the benefits they have locally and keep outsiders out, that's a barrier also. That explains a lot of our housing policy here in the Bay Area. So even though on one hand, because of the wealth and the politics of the Bay Area and California, we're often inclined to think about ways in which we can be a model and be experimental, but at the same time, there is a downside to things like Board of Health benefits and other policies at a local or state level in that they could contribute to some of those barriers to mobility.
I think Jen's raising an interesting point, but I think part of what we have to recognize is that California really is functionally like a nation state in terms of its size, not in terms of the scale of its government. Someone working in state government now does not have the resources, certainly, of the federal government, but a lot of what, and the governor talks about this idea of a California for all, really a vision for a much more inclusive and sustainable economy, and that relates to a lot of these ideas of how do we ensure mobility for individuals moving up the income level, but since we're here in an urban planning environment, and also a piece of mobility is being able to move around. Mm-hmm. And Jed talked about some of the challenges of accessing jobs in a dynamic labor market like the Bay Area, given the housing cost environments. But some of the investments we are making in California in physical infrastructure and in public higher education are about systems that give people access to opportunity. So because if an investment with high-speed rail would make Fresno, for example, an hour from San Jose, is about economic integration of the places that doesn't exist as much today. It doesn't mean necessarily that you get on a train in Fresno in the morning and get to your job in San Jose. It might mean the opposite. It might mean that a company in the Bay Area, instead of leaving California and going to another state, opens their second office in downtown Fresno or downtown Stockton, and then creates opportunities for job opportunities, higher quality jobs in other parts of the state, but that were connected to each other through an investment that the state has made.
That's what I was going to ask you, actually, because you were bringing up this point about how we are reliant on industries, workers, roles that are happening outside of the Bay Area's boundaries. How are we doing in terms of the region seeing itself, the Bay Area region seeing itself as very much interconnected with the Central Valley or...
Okay. I think we're sort of going through a learning process right now that a lot of people, for many years, San Francisco didn't see that much outside its boundaries. And as sort of labor markets changed and people couldn't afford to stay in San Francisco, increasingly there was a regional mindset for San Francisco. And the Bay Area has long been a place where people have been trying to develop that. And what does it mean? And BART was an investment in creating a regional identity. I think we're now at a moment where people are recognizing much more the interconnection at this larger geography, as many people have not been able to continue to stay in their communities all over the nine-county region, but are economically, culturally still intertwined with the Bay Area. Whether they're sports fans or they listen to KQED or part of the media market, they're still intertwined with a lot of the economic structures. And we, no matter where we are reliant on some of the work that's done. The goods movement is such a great expression of that. Meaning that the trucks that are crossing the Altamont Pass that are coming from a warehouse just over the outside of the Bay Area are totally intertwined with what we do. So I think it sort of behooves all of us to recognize that and to see that there's now 1.5 million people in the three northern San Joaquin Valley counties that are just over there. There's been significant growth, and a lot of those are people who have very strong ties to the Bay Area and are functionally a part of this area.
Well, that would be quite a transition to make, just in terms of, I think, our thinking, right? Because it's very hard for us to often think beyond our borders. But, I mean, just transitions generally. I have a couple things coming into my mind. One is, as you describe all of this, I'm wondering, are you saying, Egon, that it's okay if we don't necessarily try to develop more middle-income work here in the Bay Area region, but really support the development of those roles outside of the Bay Area, and that we should, you know what I mean?
Like, no, I'm not saying that. I think we have to start with a recognition that we are already a part of something much larger, and we have to do tremendous work to continue to try to grow middle-wage jobs. And actually, when I was at Spur, we led an initiative that was really trying to think about how to move low-wage workers up into middle-wage jobs. And one of the challenges was, how do you grow middle-wage jobs?
Yeah.
Well, you can turn low-wage jobs into middle-wage jobs, but you can also do things like major investments in infrastructure. Right, that is a distinct, specific way where you can create middle-wage work that's family-supporting wages, that are often unionized, that have a lot of the benefits Natalie was describing that we no longer have. You can do that at the scale of the Bay Area, right? And a lot of the investments you sometimes see on the ballot of, are we going to vote for this bond or this sales tax increase to fund transportation investments, that does create middle wage jobs. And those, or housing construction, as we talked about, the significant lack of that, those are the kinds of decisions that can be made here that really support it.
So Natalie, until we get there, one of the other strategies that I had mentioned earlier that you've been working on is guaranteed income. And I know that you've also been working very closely with Michael Tubbs, the mayor of Stockton, on his experiment. First, can you just remind us what that experiment is that's going on in Stockton right now? Because there's new data that's come out about it, because it's been a little while since it was implemented. So I'd be curious to also learn more about that.
Yeah, so Mayor Tubbs looked at the stats, a lot of the same stats we were looking at, that a quarter of the American workforce works full-time, and despite that is on some form of public assistance, or the wealth concentration stats that, right, 400 wealthiest families in the country have as much wealth as the bottom, 60% of households, and said, let's look at some big ideas to fix some of this. And a guaranteed income is an idea that Dr. King talked about, many of the founding fathers wrote about. It's an old idea in American history and has fallen out of favor for the last 50 years and is back now as an interesting conversation given all of that we've been laying out tonight. And so there are a lot of white papers written on what a guaranteed income could do for families. And Mayor Tubbs said, I want to do this in Stockton. Stockton is a very diverse city. It's a city where the median wage is lower than the rest of the state and in many cases the rest of the country. And it's a city that had been in bankruptcy and has now pulling itself out of it. And so it was a great city that looked like America. It was a great city to say, let's try the first demonstration of this idea. So what launched about 6 months ago is 125 families in Stockton receive $500 a month with no strings attached. Well over half of the folks are working full-time, part-time with their caregiving. About 11% of them are looking for work but are unemployed. Less than 2% of them are unemployed and not looking for work. And despite that, despite how hard this cohort is working, their average income a month is $1,800. So an additional $500 is really making a difference in people's lives.
We've had actually a couple of questions about UBI, Universal Basic Income, that feels like this is the right time to ask. This audience member writes, people who support UBI often say jobs may become scarce, but we need lots of help in childcare, elder care, building and repairing infrastructure, etc. In a choice between UBI and a WPA work program, which is more workable and will yield less inflationary forces?
I would argue we should be doing both things. I would argue that we can make a big investment in jobs and an industrial policy in America and the good jobs that come with that, and we can make a big investment in creating an income floor for people. That should be what the safety net looks like for the 21st century.
And this person writes, why and how are we having this conversation and panel without a single person of color on the panel when this issue is most concentrated in families and communities of color? And I want to thank the person who wrote this. This is also feedback that we shared with programming at KQED, and I will also share this feedback as well. This is a question actually about portable benefits. Natalie said the future of the safety net may live with the employee, but why not with the person disconnected from labor, which almost also gets maybe even a little more toward guaranteed income. But yeah, your thoughts on this sort of
I think
question.
That's a great point. That no matter how people work in America, they should have access to the benefits and protections of work in America. And for too long, we've passed laws that left people out. We passed the National Labor Relations Act that left out domestic workers and farm workers as a concession to Southern Democrats at the time, because that work was largely done by people of color who didn't have the power they needed in Washington, D.C. to change that. And so I think it is very important that as we think about redefining the safety net in the future, and as we prototype it in California, frankly, like I agree with Jed, there are some things that shouldn't be done at the state level, but we are the laboratory of democracy, and there's a lot we can try out here that ultimately needs to be adopted federally. But as we do that, we need to make sure that it includes everyone, and that all types of work are included as well.
I think one thing that's important to include in the conversation about UBI, Universal Basic Income, is to keep in mind the reasons that even many people who feel strongly about improving the safety net dramatically still oppose UBI or have concerns about it. And I think the two main kinds of concerns or objections are, first of all, thinking about what it means for work and being concerned that it may be a disincentive to work or that it reduces the importance of work in other ways, the way work contributes to identity and community and so on. And the other kind of objection is if it's universal, that is giving money to everyone, including people who don't really need it or to whom it's not urgent. And I think the really serious consideration then becomes, given that resources are finite, do we think about a universal basic income, or would we prefer twice as much money going to everyone in the bottom half of the distribution and none going to the top half for the same amount of resources? I think that's where you get the really tough questions about UBI.
And one thing also to think about, there's a number of other policies that exist on the ground, and Natalie's been very involved with thinking about the earned income tax credit as an example, which is just a, it's a lot of words there. It's essentially the idea of if you work and you earn under a certain amount, you get money back at the end of the year. It's a negative income tax, and California's just recently expanded it to a certain extent. There's a larger federal one, but it's the kind of policy tool that puts money directly into people's pockets that's built into the workspace. But I think what's clear in this conversation, there's not one policy that's a silver bullet. So a tangible thing that has happened is the earned income tax credit has gone up. Is that everything that we need to do? Absolutely not, but we are making progress on this. Community college, first couple years, are free in large parts of California. San Francisco did that. That's happening statewide. I think we have to see those as actually real progress. The minimum wage has gone up significantly in California. Jed talked about some statistics of you know, we heard that the wage growth for the low-wage workers has gone up faster. That was in part because of the minimum wage increase. So those are real things that put money into people's pockets. We don't stop there, but we have to acknowledge what's been happening, and there's a lot more to come.
Here is a question. We've got questions related to the aging of the workforce and concerns around that and equity. This particular person writes, in San Francisco, a third of individuals will be over 60 by 2030. Many will be economically vulnerable, and continuing to work will not be a choice but a necessity. The future workforce will be significantly older. So how can demand-side barriers to the employment of older adults be tackled to ensure equitable employment outcomes? And Jed, I'm just going to go back to you on this too, just because it is a broader economic question about the aging of the workforce, the challenges and potential downsides that that has, and challenges for the elderly, as well as what opportunities are available there as well, because I think you see both again.
Three things about the aging workforce and aging population. First of all, the aging population means, of course, there'll be growing demand for healthcare jobs and anything healthcare related. And that's true not just here, but nationally. Second, there may also, when we think about technological change, our instinct is to think first about ways in which jobs are destroyed or jobs are created or jobs are augmented. But technology changes people's willingness and ability to work too, the labor supply side. One of the technologies that actually had the biggest impact on work over the past many decades was the pill. The pill had a huge impact on the decisions women could make in investing in education, in career, and helped usher in an enormous increase in female labor force participation in the formal paid workforce. One of the most important technologies that affected the history of work in the U.S. There may be other technologies also that raise the labor supply of older workers. In other words, that make it easier and more possible for people to be able to and to want to work longer. The last point about the aging workforce is when we talk about the gig economy and alternative work arrangements like contracting, freelancing, and temping, we think first about like Uber and Lyft drivers sometimes, but in fact, more broadly, when we think about these alternative work arrangements, older adults are much more likely to be in alternative work arrangements, contracting, freelancing, temping, than younger workers are. Often, though not only by choice, but as the workforce ages, there'll be growing demand from older workers who might not want to work full-time or want other kinds of flexibility, that a lot of our systems, and this gets to questions of detaching benefits from traditional full-time employment, creating more ways to reduce barriers to mobility, there will be increased pressure to figure out sustainable alternative work arrangements as the workforce ages.
And I think the other side of the coin of the aging workforce is the care that's going to be needed as the population ages. And if you look at the original gig worker, it was the caregiver, as the folks at the National Domestic Workers Alliance often say. And I think that's an industry I'm watching closely to say, if we can figure out how to make care jobs good jobs, then we will be answering a lot of the questions we're talking about tonight. And it pays very low, yet feels very expensive to the families who need it, who are earning the incomes that we've been talking about tonight. So it is a looming crisis, one that good folks are thinking about and feels like the place where California has led on policy and can do even more.
This one I think is for you, Aegon, or at least I'd like to hear your answer to it. Why are climate and workforce and housing advocates not working more closely together on workforce pathways, climate goals, building electrification, for example, like things like that?
So there's a number of things in that question. One of them is we've been talking a lot tonight about automation, but underlying automation is the notion of a transition, of a massive disruption and a big change. The climate crisis and climate change generally is another massive transition. And it's a transition both in the potentially positive ways from an employment perspective and obviously the profoundly challenging one of how it's going to reshape everything. The only positive side to this is we have seen policy changes throughout the world lead to job growth in California. For example, the demand increase from Germany and other European countries in setting a high renewable target, combined with the driving down of manufacturing costs of solar panels in China, combined with California and other places also having high demand for renewable energy, leads to a significant amount of investment in solar arrays all over California. So you're seeing a footprint that comes from policy changes everywhere. Now, a lot of those jobs aren't profoundly great jobs. And I think the same conversation about home healthcare workers and solar installers, we have to think about how do we make sure that those become good jobs. And one thing to point out, we're trying to think about what are tangible solutions happening. About $30 million a year coming out of the state budget for 5 years on something called high road training partnerships. And it's very much the idea of how do you get high road employers, employers that are providing the kind of quality jobs we've been talking about, family supporting wages, worker voice, access to good benefits, in conversation and partnership with the community colleges that are providing the training, in partnership with the K-12 system, to both make a pathway for people into the jobs, but to make sure that they have the right training and skills right. as this work expands.
But speaking of effectiveness, this is another set of questions, and this is probably the last area that we'll have time to talk about. But it really is this question around how effective is the strategy of retraining in education. So this person writes, education is a barrier to economic mobility. College-level education is incredibly expensive, hundreds of thousands of dollars over 4 years, yet many middle-wage jobs possibly necessarily require a college degree. What can we do to improve economic mobility in the context of education? This is another question, what does the research say about how effective reskilling is, i.e. reskilling, upskilling with automation? Is it feasible? I mean, I think this person is talking about how to increase access to to higher education, but at the same time, I think there is this question of, is that really the most effective way to try to transition people into sustainable work? Natalie Foster, I'll go to you first.
Well, I think it's all very important. Historically, we've been wrong at what jobs would be the jobs of the future and what jobs we would train people on. You know, the anecdote is that until very recently, most federal job training programs were training people to be truck drivers. And now we know that truck drivers will be one of the fastest jobs automated out of existence through, you know, autonomous trucking and vehicles. So I think the question is, how do we get better at understanding what the jobs will be? But two, I would argue that, you know, cash is actually one of the most effective job training tools we have because it gives people the ability to seek out what they want in their own areas with their own, you know, community colleges, given their life circumstances, that sort of thing. So I do think it all goes hand in hand.
Well, training takes time. I mean, cash doesn't take as much time. So I'd be curious what you think about this, Jed, in terms of the what has been kind of the strategy that we've all gone to try to help people through all the transitions that we're going to see in work is training and education.
So I think two of the most pressing questions around training, and these are training education, and I, you know, this is not my area of expertise, and I don't have strong views one way or another, but I think two of the most important kinds of questions are, first of all, what are the skills that we should really be focusing on? The answer is almost certainly not that everyone needs to learn to code, because the skills in demand will change over time, and education training means making bets on the future. I think people are increasingly realizing that some of the essential skills are what I prefer to call deep skills. They're often referred to as soft skills, even though they're actually harder to learn, harder to automate than what are thought of as hard skills. So we'll call them deep skills. Communication skills, knowing how to read a room, translating between different fields of expertise. People are increasingly appreciating that as important as skills. I think the other really big question is, what's with this front-loading education at the start of one's adulthood? Especially given that people are going to be working longer. Some of this training needs to happen for people who are not 18 or 25. Lots of interesting experiments and ideas going on about how to parcel out education and training over the lifetime. I think one of the things, though, that this comes down to is, who pays for this and can it actually happen? Now, we are wrestling to work on this right now at a point when the labor market is probably as tight as it's going to be for a long time. This is the moment when companies have the biggest incentive to invest in training. It's not going to increase from here on out as the labor market gets less tight.
So then, to end, do you think that the companies, as you mentioned, we, the voting public, the taxpaying public, are going to have the civic will to implement the kinds of policies, invest in the kinds of things that they could potentially invest in, like training, to create the kind of range of opportunities, work opportunities that we need to create a thriving Bay Area for its residents? And if you do, give me one example why you're optimistic. So I'll start with you, Ian.
Well, I'm incredibly optimistic because I think we're at a moment of a recognition that actually the skill gap is much less than people think it is. It's a little bit of a fallacy that workers don't have skills. A lot of low-wage workers have college degrees, and so actually the challenge we face is really one of creating and maintaining and growing quality jobs, which is a lot of what we've been talking about. So I think we have to kind of keep our eye on the prize of making sure the quality of the job is good. But second of all, we have made some major investments in higher education institutions. And many people in the Bay Area, if you want to kind of think about changing some of our mental map of what's possible, if you're an employer, hire a graduate from UC Merced, hire a graduate from Stan State. There are many universities all over California where 70, 80% of the students there are first-generation college students. So college degree is not necessary for every job. It's not necessary for everyone. But there are all these institutions that are doing a profound job of educating an entirely new workforce for the state. And I think it behooves all of us to try to not have implicit bias in degrees and all sorts of other things, but to try to bring those folks into the workforce. So I think some of those investments are ones that are really worth looking at, in addition to what I mentioned earlier about free community college, really opening up those access doors of opportunity for people.
So what do you think, Jen?
So if there's one thing that we've learned over the past few years, it has to be that, like, making predictions about the popular will and what that means for politics are always 100% right. So at the risk of trying to make some prediction about will there be public and popular will, did I mention I'm an economist? We tend to be a bit more cynical on such things. I think that kind of political will often means people putting aside some of their self-interest, particularly people who have more power in the political process and are more likely to vote. Also, sacrificing some of the present in order to invest in the future. Judging from how well we've done on things like climate, housing policy in the Bay Area, you know, I'm more cynical, perhaps, about our ability to figure much of this out. I do think there will be breaking points, things that open people's eyes. You know, one of the things about work is it does involve people. It involves people who are customers, suppliers, colleagues with each other. Work is not as abstract as some of the other things that we wrestle with. And many of the most effective strategies, I think, for people understanding about, you know, the challenge of transitions, whether it's possible to live in the Bay Area on their income, comes from interactions people have personally. And those interactions do happen through work in a way that they don't always happen in other kinds of more abstract issues. And so, you know, the fact that work involves people, often doing things with and for other people, is something that does make me more hopeful about there being some public will to face some of these issues.
Natalie.
So much of what we've talked about tonight, some of the big ideas, all come down to money. And what we've talked about tonight is that it's concentrated in a very small number of hands, and that means those who've done well in the new economy are going to have to do more. And often that will mean paying more taxes. Might mean higher corporate tax rates on some hand. It might mean higher income taxes on the other hand. That would bring us on par with other developed nations. And so one thing I'm inspired by is just the number of people who are really starting to name that out loud and say, yeah, we may have to have a wealth tax in the United States. We may have to do more in order to have the just society and, frankly, the democracy that we need. So I guess the thing that inspires me is, you know, we have been for a long time talking incrementally about a very big problem. And in the Democratic, run for presidency right now, I hear very big solutions being talked about on everything from, you know, paid family leave to a wealth tax to how we rebalance the tax code and to, frankly, what the future of capitalism is, and an argument that the last 50 years of capitalism did not bring us the prosperity that's widely shared that was promised. And so how do we rethink that? And that's the moment we're in.
Well, Natalie Foster, Jed Kolko, Egon Terplin, thanks to all of you for sharing your analyses tonight. I really appreciate it. And as we mentioned, this was the second in our three-part series on Common Ground, which is in partnership with Spur, that's really exploring this question of how income inequality, or economic inequality, really is threatening the social fabric of the Bay Area. And I want to invite you to join us for more events, not necessarily just this one. There will be a third one on Thursday, November 14th, which will be talking about education and looking at structures and access to a quality public education in the Bay Area. But we would also encourage you to come to a community forum on how Silicon Valley's biggest landowners are contributing to housing, traffic, and commercial pressures. And that's going to be at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on Thursday, November 7th. And of course, you can go to our website if you want to get more information about any of these events, and that's at kqed.org/events. My name is Mina Kim. Thanks for being here.
On Common Ground is a co-production of Spur and KQED. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Radio post-production by Nina Thorson. Ryan Davis produces KQED's live events. Our editorial team includes Vinnie Tong, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.